Book 2. The Past. Kshatriyas cast out from Bharatvarsha ran further west, where people are more ignorant. The Vikings tried to cross and plunder, unaware of Lord Chaitanya's advent. Columbus sought a westward route. Mayflower pilgrims came running to start a new theocracy. Without liberation from birth and death, ready to endure hard times, they killed birds and gave thanks to God. Unlimited voyages west ensued. As immigrants entered New York's harbor, illusioned, free of old sufferings, plagued by new. In 1965, a Jaladutta voyage seemed only another, a small black merchant ship making her roundabout way from India. At sea. His face turned out to where he saw no land, but endless moving hills beneath the sky. Below the deck, in simple saffron dress, occasionally he spoke with the captain and his wife, respectable figures who saw him as a traveling saint. Not a recluse, he cooked khichdi and shared it and talked about Krishna with the ordinary seamen. The Bay of Bengal was like the ocean of birth and death. He was alone with his inner thoughts, reading the poem of Krishna Das Kaviraj, at which the metal bulkheads fell away, and he beheld the fair sight of Lord Chaitanya singing and dancing. The sea was a bridge of time separating him. It was a huge deep for a tiny soul afloat, but endurable by his will. The traveling was rough, but sheltered by the Lord, at sea and yet beyond. His mission was underway, despite the injunction against Swami's crossing. On Janmashtami and his own 69th birthday, he refused to be daunted by the vast energies of water and sky. He held to his purpose. The sea was his route, the pathway to his service, and not to be begrudged. Sickness. Deep down the ship prowed, then rose high, mounting a swelling wave, in a seasick rhythm and roll. In the hold, in a small, cramped cabin, sitting up or lying down, there was no comfort from the sea-tossed roll and pitch as rain poured down on the Bay of Bengal. More rain on the Red Sea, sudden pains in his chest, made him think he would die. Were Scindia's agents right that he would die at sea? What is the pain of a pure devotee? Only he and Krishna knew what he was willing to do, to serve his Lord in any condition. If we like, we can ask, why was Haridas Thakur beaten? Why were the Pandavas exiled and harassed? Why Prahlad tortured by his father? Why Rama banished, Christ crucified? But we cannot demand the answers. The Lord unfolds his plans as he pleases, and the devotee knows it is best for all. Prahlad never doubted. If God is almighty and just, why am I, a devotee, being tortured? In confronting the demon, he did not suffer, but remembered Krishna and attained the Lord's abode. Prabhupada tolerated 2 attacks in 2 days. But if it comes again, I will not survive. The rains and winds persisted. His dream of many forms of Krishna. On the night of the second day, Prabhupada had a dream. Lord Krishna in his many forms was rowing a boat and encouraging him along. Lord Matsya, who saved the Vedas from the flood, waved him on. To protect the Vedas from the ocean of vices, Prabhupada must reach the West and print and distribute his books. The West was drowning in sins, and Indian gurus were drowning the Vedic message in a sea of bogus speculation. Come, Prabhupada, you can cross this sea. the Lord is here. Lord Kurma of the nectar-churning Leela urged him on to America to churn the Sankirtan Amrita. Mohini Murti stole the nectar in favor of the Devas. But if Prabhupada could reach his goal, he would give immortal quaffs of Harinam to one and all. Therefore the Lord was blessing him. As the moon and gods came forth for the churning of Mandara Hill, so during the friction between demons and devotees, Srila Prabhupada appeared. And in his hour of attacks at sea, he beheld the Lord in his many forms. Come, Prabhupada, you can cross this sea. The Lord is dear. Lord Narahari's divine advent is to kill the miscreants, and he encouraged Prabhupada with his fierce demeanor, which vanquishes the demons' false dominion and assures the followers of Prahlad. The enemies would not touch a hair on Prabhupada's head, but he would kill them all with the healing, cleansing weapon of the holy name. False threats and illusions cannot sway the Lord's devotees. But Prabhupada must come at once, because until now the sons of demons have never met the teachings of Prahlad or know the protection of Nrisimhadev. As sons of demons they have only suffered, sometimes longing for another world. Come, Prabhupada, you can cross this sea. With the Lord there is no fear. Balaram and Krishna also assured, come along. They appeared to him in a most delightful way, running and frolicking in the forests of Braja, the all-attractive Lord and his brother, who deliver the most fallen as Gaura and Nitai. Let the Americans also share this nectar. Krishna is not the Hindu god. The Americans will gladly embrace him, Krishna with flute and Balaram with plow. The Westerners can relearn to love them, since all are eternal spirit souls, servants of Krishna and Rama. Come, Prabhupada, you can cross this sea. The Lord is here. Srila Prabhupada, you will cross this sea because the Lord desires. Crossing and arrival. He recovered and ate Bhatkachari, while the Jaladuta plied through smoother waters, Suez, Mediterranean, south of Italy, Gibraltar, then out upon a broad, peaceful ocean. If the Atlantic would have shown its usual face, perhaps I would have died, but Lord Krishna has taken charge of the ship. 30 days crossing, and his only solace was Chaitanya Charitamrita. He thought of the unfriendly risks, so far from their lordships, Radha Damodar. Vrindavan life was natural and sublime, at home with Krishna devotion. If life at sea was alien, what of the new land and the task ahead? He confided to his friend, Sri Krishna, a page of Bengali script, announcing a bold vision. His spiritual master's desire will prompt the whole world to chant. Alone, and coming closer to the unknown, he foresaw that the mercy of Lord Chaitanya would conquer. As the boat entered Boston Harbor, no one suspected the extent of the change to come. But history was changing from no pure devotee in the West to one. His awe heightening before the task, he drew closer to Krishna's grace. Why have you brought me here? How could Captain Pandya know, as kindly he took his saintly passenger on a short walk through Boston? Only Krishna could hear, as Prabhupada spoke with hope and helplessness, I am your puppet. Make me dance, make me dance. With early morning mist lifting, he saw the dead-spirited city, the dirty streets and buildings, the victims of Kali Yuga going to work, and he grew anxious. How could he even talk with them? How could he change them, turn them from sense delights, and show them the vanity and defeat of hopes dependent on a myth? How would they be able to hear? Only the expert mystic Krishna could change them. Prabhupada prayed for the Lord's mercy. I wish that you may deliver them. Boston was heavy, but Bhagavatam the heaviest. Bhakti science could work anywhere, its transcendental sound penetrating the deaf ear, cutting the stone heart, smothering the fire of lust, and cleansing the filthiest place. These people who ate meat, who had sex like dogs, could rise to human behavior. Those who were desperate could at last find shelter. If they could hear, the knots of their hearts and all misgivings would be cut to pieces. Prabhupada had come to give them that chance. They could stop the chain of karma if Krishna would allow them to hear. They would see the self as master if Krishna would bless his pure devotee's words. Feeling himself tiny, an insignificant beggar, Prabhupada prayed for the Lord's mercy. I wish that you may deliver them. He had no other desire. Gopal Agarwal hosted you because his father asked him to. He picked you up at Pittsburgh late at night and drove you to his butler home. When you spoke at churches, there was an uneasiness among the audience, as is natural for any religious sect. Some loved you, like Sally, Gopal's wife, and some didn't, like the reporter. Those intent on materialism misunderstood you entirely, thinking, at best, you were an Indian phenomenon. And they claimed they couldn't understand your speech. If they had known what radical changes you came to make, they would have been much more alarmed. In Butler, they saw you as an innocent, scholarly guest from India in strange robes. A child called you Swami Jesus. You spoke to students at Slippery Rock College. You looked into the supermarts and laundromats, stayed at the Y, and sat in the Agarwals' backyard. In the evening, you met guests in the living room. Then, after warm milk at 9, you rode back to the Y to rest, to rise, and to write. In the first photo, you appear confident, though you had no men or money. You stood with your open Bhagavatam. Your chatter was frayed, but you looked firm and charming and deep, an inner stability that would be difficult to shake, observed Professor Larson. It would take all these qualities and more for venturing forth at a late age into Manhattan. 2 months' sponsorship was all you had, so with half the time gone, you left for New York with a few coins and the name of a yogi you'd never met. Sally felt sick to see you go into the city without a friend. First days in New York City. Once in England on a morning walk, surrounded by loving disciples, Prabhupada spoke of his childhood. When they were building the Victoria Memorial, he climbed to the top using the scaffoldings. You must have been brave, one disciple remarked. With innocent candor, Prabhupada replied, I am still brave, or how could I have come alone? The New York yogi was just the opposite in his view of the absolute truth, but he kindly gave to Prabhupada a windowless room in his yoga studio. And it was just the kind of yoga Prabhupada had come to preach against. But he had no temple or residence of his own, so he did not complain. He had no plan except to tell everyone he met about Krishna. He sometimes sat in the back and listened, and was sometimes permitted to speak. You say the Absolute is one and we are all God, but how is it that we are now within the grips of Maya? How could God come under the sway of illusion? Yogi Mishra attempted to reply, but the Vaishnava logic pierced the fallacy that denies and insults the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Whether in New York or India, the Vaishnava cannot allow the Lord to be defamed by a jugglery of words that all is senseless, all is impersonal, God has no hands or ears or eyes to accept his devotee's service. Absolute is sentient, thou hast proved, impersonal calamity thou hast moved. Swami, said Yoga Mishra, you do not speak. But Prabhupada could chant at least, and they like to hear his bhajan. It touches the heart like something electrical, said Mishra, No one can sing like him. Students of Hatha Yoga got up and danced with him. Prabhupada, you sang so nicely, not for show, but for devotion. Somehow, you and Dr. Mishra got along. He very much liked your Krishna Prasad. Even the Mayavadi is charmed, and his students also. Swami makes the best food, they said. It is Krishna Prasadam, and Mishra advised them, he is a highly evolved man of God. On your own, you wandered out to Manhattan's streets, seeing what this place was like. You heard the horns and sirens. A Calcutta boy, you were not amazed at the population's madness. You were encouraged to preach. New York is the proudest place, you thought, but look how degraded it is. A letter arrived from Sumati Murarji. I am glad you are in better health and are already speaking in some lectures. I think you should stay until your mission is complete. Prabhupada had been thinking to soon return, but this word encouraged him to stay. If people were paying for nonsense yoga, why would they not accept the real thing? He wrote to India, to God Brothers, for help in getting a building. But it was the same as before. Just as when a God Brother had not wanted to print more than 500 copies of Sajjanatoshani, they could not dream of sending Bhaktivedanta Swami money for a building in New York. You alone. You were alone in the city where no one knew Krishna. Only a backward boy came, but Krishna in your heart was your direct companion. You had kept your courage on the lonely Atlantic and now alone in the ocean of vices. The Lord protected you just as he protects the sages in the forest, loitering in neighborhoods, thinking how they could be transformed for Krishna's mission, but it seemed impossible. And you went to Sindhya's man to ask when a ship was returning. Still you extended your stay again and again. Let me try a little longer. Subway trains rumbled beneath your feet. Steel-reinforced concrete soared to the sky. Carcasses hung in the deli windows. The laws of the streets, the laws of the traffic, rush or get run over. The false sense of uptown civilization, dignity for two-legged animals. But then, why are you here? Now, because it is my duty, I have brought some message for you people, as ordered by my spiritual master. Bhajans. Charms to soothe the savage beast, that soft jingling and your deep voice. They quieted to see how you were alone with Krishna. They sat and watched. Not caring to flatter, you gave them devotional songs, singing of Madhurya Leela, beyond the ken of the listeners, your eyes closed in ecstasy. You didn't tell them to join, but by a nod of the head you indicated it would be nice to sing. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And a few persons casually joined in chorus. First comers. Robert Nelson became the first associate to regularly visit Srila Prabhupada, to receive instructions, to help find a place for Krishna's temple. But all Mr. Robert could do was purchase a few eccentric items with money from his unemployment check. Elderly Mrs. Ferber of the Paragon bookstore refused Prabhupada, but when he returned, persistent, she fetched him a cup of water and bought his books. He sat on a city bench with a man who would never forget him, a holy man who went out alone like Elijah. Others didn't know Prabhupada, but saw him walk past on his route, Columbus Avenue to West Side Drive. They saw a Swami of 70 years, with white pointy shoes and wrapped in a gray shawl, pass by their window at a brisk pace. The word spread downtown to the health and occultish paradox that a Swami uptown in a little room had a far-out chant and whoever went could see him. In 1960s fashion, Bill Epstein went, bringing brown rice and a handshake. We are doing our thing to make reform, and so are you, so dig the scene. Prabhupada received them each. He was a deep reservoir of devotion, yet always a person, as real and ready to deal as any one of them. He regarded even the ant as worthy of respect, and shared an hour with whomever inquired. His social service was to give them Krishna. He was a real person from the spiritual world, but no one knew. They mostly saw a Swami of 70 in pointy shoes and a gray shawl quickly passing by their window. And even if they received his mantra, it was not as Shishya. The mad eclectics moved on, searching for another experience. Unfortunate lives of short duration, lazy, cheated, and always disturbed, the flotsam and jetsam jivas could not, in their downstream rush, halt to take shelter on the shore of Srila Prabhupada. He humbly offered them prasadam and gave of himself, but they could not see the value as they careened by. You in snow and cold. You awoke, looked out the window, and saw the next building all white. Someone has whitewashed? You walked outside into the cold, wet, deep. Your shoes looked less white now, and didn't keep your feet dry. Iced air rushed at your throat and head, and blew open the thin dhoti on your legs. For this climate, they had advised you, take meat and wine and wear hats, pants, coat. You accepted from Mishra a black wool second-hand coat, but did not become an uptown swami in pants and leather shoes. 7 inches had fallen overnight. The city was an emergency. At the midtown superette, you bought milk, clutching it in a brown bag. You walked through the cold and snow. The Bowery. When his uptown room was broken into and all possessions stolen, probably by the janitor, an acquaintance offered to share a Bowery loft. With youthful daring, Prabhupada agreed and shifted there for Krishna's purpose. Despite insistent warnings from an uptown friend, don't go there. Prabhupada reasoned, I do not see danger, I see everywhere as home. On one side was the Half Moon, a derelict's tavern, the Palma, a bum's hotel, above that, and on the right, Harold's tavern. In a corner of the loft, behind a movable partition, he hung his clothes on a line, arranged his papers, and went on composing Srimad Bhagavatam. A set of artists and musicians living in nearby lofts found Prabhupada more mystical than anyone else in town. They liked his music. Struggling souls covered with the mental grime of New York City 1960s, their interest held at least a hint of inquiry into the absolute. Is there a personal God, an ultimate origin that cannot be known by Western science and thought? Prabhupada saw their motives weren't pure, but as long as they were willing to take up chanting, it didn't matter. The lower depths of Manhattan became his morning walking grounds. Bums sleeping on his doorstep moved aside as he stepped into the infamous streets. To his refined taste, every feature of the Bowery was repulsive. The drunkard residents, the cold weather, the lack of tropical fruits, the faces of atheists, the constant rumble of trucks, the blaring sinful life, the absence of Vaishnavas, a roommate whom he found soon chemically hallucinating. Almost every feature meant inconvenience and repulsion. But Prabhupada smiled, enlivened. Where should he have gone instead? Some estate in the hills, far away from this madness? The city was the ideal place, by the awful fact that more tortured souls were here, and he had come to administer to them. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta had once refused a piece of land too far from teeming Bombay. After 6 months of trying, Prabhupada had now begun to gather listeners. Talking about Krishna, he was blissful in New York City. Preaching here required being completely free, not a pinch of desire. It took willingness and satisfaction to manage everything on his own, cooking and offering food to him and being satisfied in devotion. To transform the Bowery into Vaikuntha took the sweet realization of service in separation, assurance in living only for his holy name. He would go down and sit on a bench by the East River under the Brooklyn Bridge and think again about returning to India. Just a little longer, he would say to himself, let me see what Krishna desires. 3 nights weekly he was holding kirtan. Sometimes the room was almost filled. It was becoming a city happening to gather in the Swami's loft and hear the brass cymbals and watch him lead chanting, hear him speak Bhagavad Gita, adjuring them to take the truth of the soul. He would hold his audience a few hours and then talk with whomever stayed late. Like restless children, they would disperse. No one sensed the need to follow. A Village Voice reporter arrived, advised by a contact that this holy man seemed about to start a major religion. The article appreciated the Swami as honest, learned, practical, and direct. The photographer took some pictures, gray-white studies of the pure devotee in a corner of the dingy loft. Those who came reserved their right to do whatever they liked. They were inclined to save in their day an hour or two for sitting with the Swami, meditating through his musical chanting, but then leaving him after his discourse. Not what you would call disciples. Prabhupada said, I know it will take a long time, but I am patient. Moving to Second Avenue. There was assurance from the Bhagavatam that the words of Sri Bhagavan could penetrate the hearts of the conditioned souls. And personally, he had realized, foreign as it seemed to American life, that here was a place for Krishna consciousness. Already they were seeking after yogis, and the Mayavadi's mission had a building uptown. Indian dancers and musicians drew crowds, and Prabhupada, alone on the Bowery, had attracted an artistic set who came to chant with him. If he could only stay and persevere, he knew that it would work. But when his roommate went crazy, Prabhupada had nowhere to go. A few days he stayed with Michael Grant, then Carl gave him a place despite his wife's resentment. She feared the Swami would change her man into a liberated soul, free of illicit sex and drugs. Prabhupada knew when he wasn't wanted. Precariously he waited, asking friends to find another place. In Carl's refrigerator he saw meat and had to put his own fruits and vegetables there. If he could not bear it, then he would have to give up preaching in America. So he prayed to Krishna, what can be done? Please protect me and allow this mission to come forth. On a hot day in June, he moved, walking 10 blocks to the new address. He was never really of the Bowery, yet he lived among its residents, always kind and profound, giving them the best of spiritual life. They were not eligible to know the mysteries of Radha Krishna or the Uddhava Gita or the Bhagavad Gita, but he gave them whatever they could take. The Gita is only for the devotee, said Prabhupada. Others will think the Lord's injunction, surrender everything to me and I will protect you, is too much to ask. Then is the beginning of the Gita, we inquired, where Krishna explains the body is not the self, is this at least suitable for the non-devotee? Prabhupada replied, no, that is also only for the devotee. Who else can understand that he is spirit soul, eternal servant of God? They have to become devotees. Second Avenue, with traffic pouring noisily past the front, seemed not an ideal tirtha, but the souls were falling off from here, and so it was a good place to catch them. he walked out in his new neighborhood and saw the gas station people and the tombstone people, and they saw him. The Empire State Building was plainly in view, like a huge hypodermic needle, standing falsely proud. And the plane of the avenue was sprawling uptown into congestion and sordid lives. Prabhupada was used to New York and ready for a step forward, as fresh and eager as a young boy. Storefront. A small storefront was all he had. He walked inside, surveying, hopeful. From the second floor apartment's window, fruitless trees in the courtyard, and a gas station to the left. All right, from here I will try again. At night, in the storefront, under a single bulb, Vaishnava Tilak, marking his golden forehead, his expert, shapely hands and fingers gripping the cartel cords, he looked out at the motley crowd. He sat on the floor on a straw mat, the same level as they, leading the chant. When he spoke, they did not know Bhagavad Gita or Mahabharata or refined Vedic manners or kshatriyas or prasad. They did not know his Bengali Vaishnava childhood, his lifetime in preparation, his father, his Guru Maharaj, the wars, riots, famines, the British Raj, Gandhi, Nehru, his years in Delhi sacrificing. They did not know Vrindavan or Lord Chaitanya. All they knew was Western, gadgets and philosophies, blue jeans, suicides, rock and roll, and LSD. The most educated thought him to be a Hindu. But Prabhupada was not contemptuous or unnerved by them. He was grateful they had come. His 10 months in America had been hard, so a few eager persons were dear to him. His talk was standard. Krishna the Supreme is good for everyone. The message needed no updating. He urged them with fervor and with logical discourse from the Acharyas, Jiva, Rupa, Sanatan. He was lecturing on how everyone can serve the Lord. When a Bowery bum entered, whistling and stumbling and carrying toilet paper rolls, making his way up front, the grizzled bum donated the rolls at Prabhupada's feet, then exited. Prabhupada smiled and said, "Just see. He is not in order, but he thought, here is something. Let me give some service." Midway in his lecture, an arguer stood up. "Wait a minute, man. I want to speak." Prabhupada had to handle them like a lion tamer, an amused philosopher, a tolerant saint, a stern defender of the storefront. Kirtan captured the singers, shut up the outside world of trucks and street shouts. The sounds rang rhythmically, shining with golden rays, comforting and gladdening the hearts of those who tried it. He could hold them for 2 hours. In the last minutes, they were the most receptive, watching as he cut an apple into halves, quarters, eighths, and served it from a wooden bowl. For the moment, they were all his disciples. Then they bolted out the door into the artificial night, pursuing fantasies of desire, unaware they could surrender. He liked the people who came, fallen though they were, and he remained with them, extending his love. Gita scholar and Krishna knower, tending to the whole world, he was a true minister on the Lower East Side. A Lower East Side voice. A guru means you can take from him spiritual information like a priest or a mystic, a scholar of the texts. But to live with him or to be his servant is asking a little too much. A guru is like a mentor. You could say Bob Dylan is a guru, Timothy Leary an LSD guru. So the Swami is a genuine guru of the Vedic spiritual realm. But, I mean, you can regard him as a guru without being his follower. He lives alone, I think. We go there sometimes and sing with him. He doesn't have much money. After his kirtan, he passes a basket. I think he must live on that. And he may sell some of his books. What he says seems to be true. Teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, The Self is eternal. Krishna is the name of God. And if you always chant Hare Krishna, you'll get self-realization. It's great that he's on the Lower East Side. It adds to the scene to have a genuine guru who gives out food. And if you want to get high, try chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The summer of 1966. You began to gather them. They came to you. Keith and Chuck and Howard and Wally and Mike and Steve and Ray and Bruce and Stanley and Bob and Jim, looking up to you with the first inkling that one has to surrender to the Guru. Spending the summer in coming to you, taking the storefront and your back room as hallowed places. Religiously attending the evening class, they effortlessly gave up drugs, while losing a taste for illicit sex, not trying to give these up, but like a snake throwing off his old skin. They came to you, the first to consider you as their spiritual father, enjoying your elderly spiritual company, ragtag eclectic youth, but plain and simple enough to see clear truth through the mind's confusion that you are their spiritual master. The hot city summer passing, their lives came to new birth, confiding to one another, this is really it. We should not kid ourselves and assume to know everything. Swami is telling the truth. Why try to be smart over what we've read and what drugs and women we've known? There's nothing to be proud of. Let's face it, he is our spiritual guide. A kindergarten of spiritual life, a free grounds of learning for the first time. They unlearned the old empirical ways, gaining hope in God consciousness, what they always wanted. The Swami said, I am not God, but the Guru is as good as God. For a week they misunderstood, thinking he had said that he was God. They went to him and he clarified, no, never God, but servant of God. But therefore you should honor. The Swami said, we are going on an outing to Dr. Mishra's ashram to show them how to chant with heart and soul and to be together in the countryside. One day, you should also aspire to get such a place for Krishna. The Swami said, if I told you everything at once, you would faint. You should all become devotees. Hours and hours of inquiry, days and nights in learning and dreams, that the Swami is like Krishna and we are Arjuna, that the Swami is really like a beautiful youth. Each wants to be alone with him for the confidential exchange to ask the questions a little child can ask his father. Why is the sky blue? Where does God come from? Can I really be saintly and not slide back again? And taking private assurance from him. LSD is not needed, the Swami said. Your spiritual life is already here. Whatever he said was passed around, slowly at first, some still skeptical, joking on his name. The Swami. Old Swami cigars, old Swami rum, they said. But I said, ah, don't joke about him. The Swami said, we are going to the UN. In sneakers and jeans, they rode the bus to UN Plaza, but they were not allowed kirtan. This is a silent vigil. But Prabhupada adjusted. Standing erect, with morning river breezes rustling his saffron, he spoke and then sat with his boys, chanting japa in a ring around the monument. These vigils will never work, he said, unless they turn to Krishna. The Swami said, you can come into my room in the off evenings. They lost the key and had to break the door, then lost it again and forgot to replace the lock. They used his bathroom but didn't clean it. They failed to allow an important visitor to see him, slept through his classes, argued with one another, read Ramakrishna and then asked his permission to do so, spoke loosely and slept extra hours, hung around lazily in the storefront, kept long hair and old musical tastes, and wondered how Krishna could really have 16,000 wives. The Swami said, what do you know? You are wet behind the ears. You only know your mother's womb. You are prejudiced in favor of the scientists and proud of American highways. You're on the material platform. You don't know what you speak. You are like the rascals who are cheaters. Your impersonal conception of Krishna is foolish. What do you really know? You are simply rascals, all nonsense rascals. Don't mind if I say so. The Swami said, "Just come and eat with us each noon, all you want." And there was no charge. "Just come with the boys and sit and take prasadam. Keith will cook. I have taught him and call him Kitchen Ananda. You just come and take all the hot rice, hot sabji, hot chapatis, fresh fruit, as you like. To your heart's content, take more, take more. Sit on the clean floor with plates in a circle. Take prasad in the sunlit front room. Say the prayers and eat to your heart's content. And not just once, but never again go hungry. Don't eat in a restaurant or go lonely with bad food. Just come and I will be with you. I will show you the best food, the best everything." The Swami said, "Chant one round," and sat with the boys at 6 a.m. Quiet session so as not to enrage the neighbors. But eternal wisdom was with him. In the fresh morning, a revolutionary movement with this revolutionary thought: everything, including the telephone, is actually spiritual as long as you use it in Krishna's service. There is no other qualification for spiritual. "Now, take this knowledge and be strong," he said. "The next time we meet, I will teach you more, such as how to share this with others." The First Initiation by One Who Missed It. "I didn't know that you announced it, but there was a day set, Janmashtami. We would meet all day in the temple storefront. At night there would be initiation, and anyone who wanted could take it. You had us chanting on beads the large red wooden cherries, strung on a white cord, a knot between each of 108. Am I kidding myself? I thought, sitting on a bench at a traffic strip on First Street, chanting and reading the Bhagavatam. Is this real or imagined? I couldn't say for sure, but went on. It was new, and I felt like an old sage, passing beads through my fingers and hands. Rising early, chanting, taking to the life he was giving, I became enthusiastically free. The tyranny of buildings, no more. Meaninglessness in the office, no more. Desperate, lonely relations with friends, no more. I felt real life, and more than anything, a natural duty. To not have taken what he offered would have been the greatest cop-out. Everyone should take to it, but at least I myself had to do it. Everything had been leading to this. Hadn't I expressed it the week before my first meeting with the Swami, when in a room with East Side buddies, I had said, "I'm looking for something to worship, but I don't know what it is." So when it came, the ancient, authorized science of Gita, meeting with ever-fresh Krishna, the Supreme, and the bona fide, self-realized soul, a spiritual father and friend, when he actually came, how could I refuse him and live with myself as honest? I chanted while going to work, under my breath, on the telephone, in my silent mind, above the din of nonsensical talks, and, open-hearted and loud, in the company of devotees in the storefront, open-throated also when on the street, singing Hare Krishna. And the book, Bhagavatam, the red brick volume, was always in my office drawer, and I would open and glimpse at the strange printing from India, the new world of the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead.